Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. When schools closed abruptly in March, it was hard to imagine we'd still be fighting the pandemic in September. But here we are about to begin the new school year while a highly contagious and deadly virus circulates. The health and safety of students and staff is the number one priority as schools make plans to start the new year. The challenge? How to do that while also engaging students in learning and ensuring their social and emotional well-being. There are no easy answers, and it's likely plans laid out now will be revised in the coming weeks and months. Today, we take a look at how local districts are planning to reopen. We'll hear from a teacher and member of the Mass Teachers Association about concerns with in-person learning models, and we'll talk with school administrators about the biggest challenges they've had as they plan to reopen schools. We also want to hear from you, parents, guardians, teachers, and others. What are your thoughts on reopening schools in the time of a pandemic? Are you concerned about the physical or emotional health of students, teachers, yourself? 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We start the conversation with Dr. Gregory Parkinson. He's a pediatrician and parent. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. The American Academy of Pediatrics issued a statement that says, quote, strongly advocates that all policy considerations for coming school year should start with a goal of having students physically present in school. Now, I don't know if you agree with the statement or not, but I'm hoping you can explain why in-person learning is so important to the well-being of children.
Right. Well, that's a good question. And I think, you know, I would begin by saying, you know, we're in such a difficult time, and, you know, everyone is so stressed, for lack of a better word, and we're trying to find calm and good policy in the middle of all this, and so all of the decisions are complicated, as everybody knows. When the AAP talks about, you know, starting from the idea of children being present in school, they're recognizing, first of all, that learning is obviously most well set up to take place in person, that that for especially kids who have either educational or social or medical needs, that the online platform has serious limitations that are yet to be, I would say, well overcome. And so the fear is that in a virtual-only world, the most vulnerable children will be the ones that will suffer the most, and they're already the ones at most risk.
Mm. Now, most in-person learning across the country was suspended in March, and what did we learn about the negative impacts of school closures on children, like, you know, food insecurity, social isolation? There was a lot of things we learned from this.
Right. So it's important to step back and look at the big picture in terms of what does school closure or, you know, virtual learning do to not just learning, but to health, and not just medical health, but to social emotional health, and we know that obviously there was the surprise of the suddenness factor that contributed to it, but you know I think there's a general consensus that education from March to June was not what it was from September to March, wherever you look at it. We know that, you know, all those things you mentioned, people who are food insecure, you know, and rely on school breakfast or school lunch, that was an issue. We know that children for whom school is a refuge from any challenges that might be going on in their home, it's an issue. And we, you know, so we know that you know, the risks of things such as domestic violence and such. You know, I think it's also, when I say you look at the big picture, I think it's also to recognize that not all school reentry is equal. It starts with, and this was in the American Academy of Pediatrics statement as well, I made note of, it is vitally important that communities take all measures to limit the spread of COVID. And so communities, and so it starts with what is going on at the community level. And so if we were personally, if I was somewhere like Georgia or Florida or Texas right now, I would be totally against the idea of returning to class, because the burden of illness in the community is such that it is not realistic to think that it's not going to catch, and spread the way that, we're seeing that it is. I think all of us as community members have responsibilities, not just to ourselves and our own families. Obviously, we have them to the elderly and the vulnerable medically in the population, but also to the children and the teachers and the healthcare workers who, when people flaunt the three clear recommendations, wash your hands, wear a mask, stay socially distanced, we need everybody in the community to do that, because it's what's going on in the community that determines what's going to happen in the schools. Mm-hmm. The schools are taking unprecedented steps, and I've been involved with two school districts, and I talked to multiple other people, and the amount of effort that's being done at an infrastructure level to try to do everything that's practical to make schools safe is really laudable. What we need in addition to that is for people in the community to be respectful of one another, to go the right direction down the grocery aisle, to wear their mask over their nose, to limit their social contacts. These are the things that are going to determine the success or failure of schools, not so much what's being done in the schools themselves.
Yeah. And yesterday, public health officials said all students are required to have a flu shot before the end of the year. It kind of seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, you got flu season coming, you still have the pandemic. We want to try to cut down the flu as much as possible.
As a pediatrician, I would say that it's a no-brainer also. I don't want to take away from the courage and the vision that the DPH showed by making this decision, though. This was a bold decision, which I think is fantastic, because, one, it is going to reduce the number of kids with fevers and coughs, make the job of school nurses, the job of anyone, a little more straightforward. Second, we're going to have less people coughing, which, if anyone has the flu and COVID at the same time, they can potentially be spreading both. And third, it's important to recognize that the flu, has been under-recognized as a burden on people's health. And by reducing the amount of flu, that's something we can do to increase the safety and comfort level for teachers and students. And it's really a bold move and a good one.
Yeah. One of the concerns about in-person learning, of course, is the infection and spread of the coronavirus. Let's start with students, say, age 5 to 12. How likely are they to become infected and spread the virus? Do we know?
So, I'm gonna sidestep that one a little bit, Mindy, because I think the practical issue is this. People of any age can contract the virus. People of any age can spread the virus. There is still argument about how much you relatively do it at different ages, and the jury is still out on that. But the bottom line is that people of any age can do that. What's important is, what is the likelihood of somebody age 5 to 12 become seriously ill from COVID-19? And that answer is extremely low. Even in medically fragile children, their chances of becoming seriously ill from COVID-19 are dramatically lower than becoming seriously ill from the flu, say. Mm-hmm. So when people ask me, is it safe for my child to go back to in-person learning, I say, who do you live with and who do you see? Because it's not what's going to happen to these children by and large. You can all, there's always an exception, and You know, I said, if you show me a splinter, I can show you how one in 100,000 times that can be really serious. But for children, young children, this is not a serious illness in the vast majority of cases. I am not worried about the children. I am worried about everyone that are around. And so they do have the potential to spread it. We don't know exactly how much, but they do have some potential to spread it. And they're more likely to have no symptoms than people who are older. And so they do represent a group that, you know, you can get complacent with and get fooled with. And so that's how I would frame that.
Yeah. And we have a lot of grandparents raising grandchildren, and this is a real concern for them is, do I send my grandkids back to school? Yeah.
Right. That's tough. I think, you know, the whole issue of grandparents and people who are, medically fragile is very important. That is the question that I think each family should be asking, is who would be at risk if my child goes back to school? We all are struggling with our older relatives. You know, my parents are in their 80s and I haven't seen them since October, and it's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. The thought of the only thought that's worse than not seeing them is seeing them and then giving them something that could be, you know, potentially fatal for them. So it's a very important decision.
Yeah. Now, there are some children that prefer remote learning, but the vast majority of kids want to be in school. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the social, emotional benefits of a person in school for, you know, and just thinking, you know, we talk about a lot about younger children, but for teenagers, this is important as well. And that isolation is tough on kids of all ages.
Absolutely. So, and there's a couple of, you know, there's so many things we could talk for hours about in there. I would frame it in two directions. This is difficult for children. It's difficult for adults. What September have kids ever been so excited to go back to school?
Right.
So their appreciation for, wow, I never knew school could be so great and did so many great things for me, is important. When we see the young people struggling, the teens and the young adults, it's because they're at an age where their development is driving them to be social and independent. And so they're struggling with that. And, you know, frankly, they're not doing a very good job of it, and they need to do a better job of it, the young adults. But it is going against the grain of what their brains are telling them they want and need to do. And I think that's important to understand. I think as well, Mindy, it's really important to see a silver lining in what this can mean for children and young adults and older adults, teachers, you know, people my age, people your age. Most of us have lived in a relatively good time. People have had more than they haven't had, and people have not had to do things for the greater good in the way that past generations have. If you look at our military families, people who have been deployed, people whose family members have been deployed, those people in the last 20 years know exactly what it's like to sacrifice and know exactly what it's like to do the really hard thing. And they probably also know exactly how much resilience and strength that has given them as people moving forward and trying to be better in their lives. And we have to really see the potential here to help our children to become a stronger generation because of the difficulties that they're doing. They are going to appreciate freedom. They are going to appreciate friends. They are going to appreciate the day when they don't have to wear a mask. And they're going to even appreciate education more than they did.
We're talking about reopening schools in the time of a pandemic. Coming up after a break, we'll hear the perspective of teachers who have concerns about in-person learning models. You're listening to The Point, and we are discussing how to reopen schools safely in the time of a pandemic. We want to hear from you, parents, guardians, teachers, and others. What are your thoughts on reopening schools? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is pediatrician Greg Parkinson, and joining us is Chelsea Craig. She's president of the Sandwich Education Association and a teacher in the Sandwich Public Schools. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, in a moment, we'll talk about district reopening plans. But earlier this month, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education issued guidelines to help districts determine if they should have in-person learning, a hybrid plan, which combines in-person with remote learning, or if they should be offering only remote learning. Chelsea, the Mass Teachers Association, the union that represents teachers on the Cape and Islands, has mm-hmm. called for all remote learning to start the school year. And you are in agreement. Explain why you think schools should start out remotely.
So I am privileged enough to work in a district where I believe that we can quickly transition from remote to a hybrid in-person model. However, most districts, especially on the Cape, are still waiting on this really essential and critical component to reopening buildings safely. And that is a neutral third-party report that analyzes the HVAC and filtration systems within each of the buildings in every school district. So speaking with the other local Cape Association presidents, we determined that if we can't have this data, if we don't get this information, then it is not prudent for us to re-enter the buildings without knowing how air ventilation and circulation operates. So in Sandwich, personally, we are asking for a two-week remote start, so it doesn't necessarily change the date of when students are to arrive to us. However, they would just be arriving virtually rather in person. That also allows for public data, public health data, to catch up a little bit, because we know that here in a tourist area, the map that was put out by the governor is a little misleading because those white and green towns can turn red overnight. So we think a two-week start is fair. And other districts that don't have the resources to begin the year safely in person are asking for longer periods of time. So this is really a district-by-district basis. And MTA's point is that we begin school only when it's safe. And listening to the American Academy of Pediatrics, I absolutely agree that there are unknown repercussions about what remote learning looks like. But I also believe that we don't know the long-term effects of being in an unsafe building with COVID down the road. So we need to look at safety first here. And we are, you know, there's a lot of professional development happening over the summer for teachers to address social emotional learning in a virtual way. Because we also know that at some point during the year, we are likely to be remote. Despite this really bold and wonderful mandatory flu shot situation, it is still likely that we'll need to shut down for a period of time because this is unknown and nobody is taking any risks to make sure that our students and staff stay safe.
Yeah. The school year has got a delayed start in many schools. And, as you know, this creates all sorts of challenges for parents. And, of course, we can't ignore the possibility that schools might have to go all remote in the late fall or winter if the virus spikes. So how do you respond to those who say, well, let's get the kids, especially the younger ones, back in school sooner rather than later?
So this is a tricky situation. I myself have a 4.5-year-old, so I'm balancing this as a teacher and also as a parent. And I don't actually live in the town where I work, so I'm trying to keep track of both Cape towns and what they come out with protocol-wise. So for parents, you know, I think our biggest plea is that I would assume that they want to send their children back to a space that they know is safe as well. We know this poses challenges for continuing to keep your children home, from working it out with your employer that you need additional or ongoing types of childcare. We too want to see our children back in the buildings, but we just want to make sure it's safe for them first. So we're waiting on these reports with hopeful hearts, assuming that they're going to come back and give us recommendations that we can make changes to get back in the building as quickly as possible. Because as educators, that's our goal too. We want to be in our classrooms. We want to see our bulletin boards and access our materials and be able to see our students in front of us. That energy is unparalleled, especially when you compare it against what it looks like to go into a Google Meet or a Zoom classroom.
Yeah.
It's nice to see their faces, but it is entirely different. So our goal is to get back in the buildings as well. But we just want to make sure they're safe before we do that.
Yeah, it's remarkable how quickly teachers shifted to remote learning this spring with so little prep time. So, and you sort of touched on this with ongoing education in the summer. So are you feeling teachers are more prepared for remote and hybrid learning at this point now?
Yes, most certainly. So hybrid will be a new challenge for us because we'll be looking at an in-person as well as students virtually at the same time. That's, I think, unknown for most educators. But in terms of remote, we switched on a dime on March 13th, and we learned as we go, and there were many mistakes made. And remote learning this round is very different from what happened in the spring. There are schedules, there are protocols, there's etiquette. We've taken, most educators on the Cape have taken a course called Modern Teacher over the summer, which really highlights specifically how to run an asynchronous and synchronous model in a remote setting. So I'm feeling like we're in a much better place to go remote. There's always more PD to happen. I mean, we're only in this not even a year, and teachers have been teaching for 20 or 30 years and still learning new things to do in the classroom to improve their practice. So I'm sure there's more PD to come as needed, but I think we are feeling much stronger about what happens when we need to be in a remote model this year.
Chelsea Craig is the president of the Sandwich Education Association. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us, Chelsea.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah. Greg, we know so much more about transmission of the virus now than we did back in March when the schools closed. Airborne particles of the virus can travel a lot further than we thought. And if we don't remove those particles from indoor spaces, transmission can occur. And Chelsea brought up a good point about HVAC systems. There's so much that we can do to make buildings safer. But, you know, everybody's trying to do that. So I imagine trying to get these jobs done is probably quite a backup. But once the weather gets a little bit cooler and students are inside, even wearing masks, do you expect the transmission rates to increase?
Well, again, I think the transmission rates are most likely going to reflect what's going on in the community at large. And I think, you know, I compare it to the ability to protect your home in good weather versus a hurricane. And so, you know, if there's a hurricane, and I would label what is going on in some states as, you know, that kind of a storm, the ability to withstand that is overwhelmed. You know, if the weather is like it is on the Cape today and it's sunny and clear and calm, then it's very different. And in between is obviously that's where the tough decisions lie. Where's the point you draw the line? And so, you know, obviously we want good ventilation systems, and we want good ventilation, period. And we want to limit the social contact of people. And, you know, while we're at it, I will throw out there that I disagree with the MIA's decision to allow soccer and field hockey to go ahead this fall. That just came out, my understanding was just yesterday, that goes against the principles of social distancing. And so all of these things determine how much virus is or is not in the room, and that is going to be more important than the ventilation. Now, the ventilation is also important, but these other things are going to, trump that.
Yeah. Joining us now is Pam Gould. She's superintendent of the Sandwich Public Schools. Welcome back, Pam.
Thank you. Good to hear you from you again.
Pam,
not
as of today,
time,
what's the plan to reopen the Sandwich Public Schools?
Generally speaking, you mean, just overall?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've worked really hard. One of the things that we took very seriously at the very beginning was this idea that, you know, parents who do have to work outside the home, this has been a long haul for them since March 13th, right? And so this, we set a priority to figure out a way, if possible, to get our youngest students into the building every day of education. That way, that would allow parents that do have to work outside the home. Not every district has the ability to do that, but we did. You know, our principals worked really hard at figuring out and looking at the building, assessing the openings, you know, what spaces could be available, how could we spread this out, et cetera. So we were able to present a plan that called for our pre-K to 6 in the building every day. I'll come back to Wednesdays in a minute, but every day of in-person learning will be face-to-face. The secondary was tougher because, A, the bodies are bigger. We have much more. You can't cohort kids the same way you can at the elementary school, just because if you remember back to your high school days, we're trying to help kids get off to college and making sure they're having all the opportunities academically. And so that posed a problem at the secondary level and then trying to limit the amount of kind of contacts that people would have. So we ended up, like most high schools, a hybrid at our grades 7 to 12 as they're all in the same building. So those kids will be live with their teacher face-to-face 2 days of the week, while the other half of the population, in a sense, is remoting into that class, like a college class, mm-hmm. live going from there. And then they'll flip the other 2 days of the week so that they're, again, getting to see their teachers live 2 days a week. And then Wednesdays for us is a home learning day. It was very important that we all acknowledge that what we're about to embark on face-to-face, even though the teachers were thrown into this unusual situation back in March, we knew we had work that we could improve on. And so I heard Chelsea at the very end and talking about the work that they've done, our teachers, a lot of our teachers this summer. But still, the idea of this moving forward is going to be significant. They need planning time. They need time to work through a lot of that. They need some continued professional development. And if we're going to do this different than we did in the spring and do it right, we need the time to do that appropriately. So we'll assign students kind of work at home, just also away from the computer, hopefully a lot, so that they can get away from that a little bit. So sorry to be so long-winded, but it's a pretty robust plan.
Yeah. What kinds of modifications have you made to your HVAC systems in the school buildings? And is there a way to assess how well they're working?
Yeah, of course. Right from the very beginning, we knew this was going to beckon early March and April, we knew that this was going to continue to be an area that was going to be a focus. So we change our filters, obviously, a couple times a year anyway, so we knew we were going to do that more often. We brought in a contractor to do an assessment of the system and really look at the functionality of where we're at. We've got two different systems, in a sense, because we have Forestdale and Oak Ridge schools. Our elementary buildings were built the exact same year. So they have systems that were built in the late 1980s and put into functionality in 1990. And then you have our 7 to 12 building, which was, again, the system was built in the late 1990s and put into functionality in 2000. So they are two different systems, and so that we wanted to check. So we've increased, I'm learning a lot about MERV filtration and all those kinds of things. But the STEM in the high school were able to put in a MERV 13 based on the system and what it could take. You can't put a MERV 13 into the Oak Ridge and Forestdale. The system just doesn't take it. So we're at a MERV 9 there. And then what we've done there is then we've also added more outside air into the system. We've opened, you know, you make sure that the windows are open, and that's the way that system is meant to function. Yeah. And then what we also did was we brought in an engineer so we've had somebody come in and check how was it running, how was it functioning. Now we wanted to say, are there any recommendations? And I was listening with Chelsea. We're waiting to hear. I don't know that this report is going to be the panacea for everybody, but what we're looking for is recommendations. How well is it running? Is there anything else we can do? And go from there.
Yeah. What's been your biggest challenge in reopening the schools?
I said this to somebody the other day, that literally, and I've been in education my entire professional life, over 30 years, there is literally not one single thing about opening a school year that is the same. Not one thing. As simple as figuring out a bathroom routine. You don't think about that even to open a school year. But we have to figure out how are we going to make sure and what is the schedule for students washing their hands, making sure we have enough hand sanitizer in classrooms. It's like nothing I've ever experienced. And I joke with a class I teach, there is nothing, I went back in my Admin 101 book, there is no chapter for this at all. So that I'd say that. And then the second piece, probably just as important, is this: the emotional side of no matter what you do and you're trying to do the best you can for everybody, you're literally going to, there's only half the people that are going to like what you're doing.
Right.
And that's very difficult.
You're not going to please everybody.
You're not. And that's, you know, that's not our field. We don't like that. We don't do well with that in education. We do want to please everybody. We want to make sure that we're meeting the needs of all of our parents, of our students, and this is difficult. So it's tough.
Yeah. Pam Gould is superintendent of the Sandwich Public Schools. Pam, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Of course, anytime.
Mindy, right,
go ahead, Greg.
Add on to what was just said in the learning part of this. Is that it's going to be a continuing learning experience. Just like we all now know about what infectious threats are posed in an indoor environment when people didn't even think about that, you know, in regular conversation 2 years ago. And so now it's raised questions, and there's going to be a continuing process. And my hope is that schools will have a continuing pipeline where, you know, issues can be generated and then, you know, you can troubleshoot them and then come up with a plan or improvement. So that, you know, I think it's very important that people, you know, administrators and school physicians and everyone to be listening to concerns that are coming out of the schools and then working with those to gradually increase the level of safety.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about reopening schools in the time of a pandemic. 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is pediatrician Greg Parkinson. And also joining us, Scott Carpenter. He's the superintendent of the Monomoy Regional School District. Welcome back, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mindy.
So give us a quick synopsis of your plans to reopen the district.
Sure. Families were given the option to choose between fully distance learning or an in-person learning option. 75% of the families, roughly, have elected for in-person learning. And developing that plan, we wanted to focus on safety first and foremost. You know, all students and staff, regardless of age, will be required to wear masks. We will have 6 foot plus social distancing in all classrooms and through the building. I think just as Pam Gold had mentioned, we wanted to really make sure that families with younger children are supported so that they can go to work if that's what the family needs. And I know that 45% of our Monomoy families need the schools to function for them to go be able to work. So we will have full day in-person learning pre-K through 7 in grades 8 through 12, which is our high school. We will have in-person learning 2 out of every 3 days. The students will rotate with 1/3 of the high school learning remotely. And on that remote day, they will have the classes streamed live to them so that they can actually participate in the class during the class period, answer questions, have the teacher ask questions of them, so that it'll be as if they're in the classroom just from their homes. I think we have 25% of our families have opted for distance learning, which will largely be a continuation of how we did distance learning this past spring. In developing the distance learning plan we used this past spring, we prioritized connecting virtually face-to-face with every child every day. And by leveraging the connections that we had already with our students, there was a consensus that we had a pretty strong distance learning program in place, and we'll just continue that and actually improve upon it as we go into this new school year. But I do also have shared with families there are significant shortcomings when it comes to distance learning. It's much more effective if the student has a strong support system at home to augment what's happening in real time. My own children had two well-educated parents in their lives who you know, were able to largely work from home and support the distance learning that was happening. You know, on the contrary, you know, distance learning does have the potential to magnify achievement gaps, and that's a big concern that I've had through this, you know, particularly with many of our most needy and vulnerable children. You know, two very concrete examples. I live in a diverse neighborhood in Hyannis. My next door neighbors are a family from Jamaica with two young children. The adults have, you know, work hard to go and make sure that there's a roof over the head or over the family's head and food on the table, and didn't have the option to work remotely throughout this pandemic. So when, you know, school was happening, you know, two young children were having to navigate distance learning on their own. And it's sufficient to say that, you know, that it was, you know, a case where the achievement gap widened for two kids there. I've also recently welcomed a foster child into my home who attended an off-Cape school in an urban district in Massachusetts. And the last time that this child last interacted with teachers was early in March. You know, so another vulnerable child was left behind by distance learning, and the achievement gap widened there. So in developing our plan, you know, we prioritized, you know, doing in-person learning safely. And I do know that distance learning can work well for some, but I want to make sure that, you know, we have a strategic priority in our district to close achievement gaps. And that in-person learning, we think, is tremendously important to help close those and not see them widen.
Yeah. Let's talk to Rick, who's giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Rick.
Oh, good morning, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I'm a science teacher at Provincetown Schools, and we're one of, I think, the only schools or few schools on the Cape that's actually planning to open remotely for the first 2 weeks. So our school year will begin in mid-September, just like other schools are doing, but we're planning to be fully remote for at least the first 2 weeks of school. Provincetown's in a unique situation where it's a small town with a tourist destination and a population that's coming from all over the country. And we're looking to have some time to actually figure out what our local population, where possible spread could take place, and what our population really needs to deal with. So we're really taking a proactive stance to try to open, to make sure that it's safe, not just for students, but safe for school staff and safe for their families and safe for the community.
Rick, thanks for calling and sharing that information with us. We appreciate that. Thank you, Rick. And Justin writes, good morning and thank you for this discussion. I hope you have some people on the other side of the coin who believe it's very important that no matter what, kids need to be in school. Children are the least susceptible to getting sick. Most of their parents also have a very minimal to no symptoms from this disease, and that only the smallest minority are affected with any severity. We are sacrificing the 99% for the 1%. Put our kids back in school. This is from a parent of a seventh grader. Thanks, Justin, for sharing your thoughts on that. Scott, at some point, it's likely someone in one of the school buildings will test positive for the virus. Describe how you will assess the risk to others and the protocols that you'll follow.
You know, I had a parent forum I think it was last week, and, you know, somebody asked the question, you know, sort of, you know, when, you know, what's the threshold? And I suspect that that many of my superintendent colleagues will be in the exact same place where, you know, I say that our threshold becomes one. And, you know, and that I anticipate that, you know, if we have a student who tests positive or a teacher that tests positive, you know, we would first, you know, quarantine and shift. You know, we've talked about making sure our plans are such that we can pivot on a dime and shift a classroom or shift an entire building or an entire school district from, you know, from in-person learning to distance learning. You know, so we would, you know, we would probably in an abundance of caution, you know, go with and quarantine a whole classroom of children. And in my district, you know, even though everybody's wearing masks and everybody will be at least 6 foot distanced in that classroom, I can't imagine, you know, not wanting to at least err on the abundance of caution end of that. You know, so I think, you know, we just have plans that we've been working through with our nurses on when we'll be sending children home who may be showing symptoms. And you can imagine that that's going to happen far more often this year than in past years, because so many of the symptoms that kids typically show up to a nurse's office are symptoms that are also related to COVID-19.
Yeah. And Dr. Parkinson, this is a year, normally we might send the kids off to school when they're a little bit sick, right? Don't have a fever. But this is important that we keep kids who are sick home, right?
Absolutely. So it's again, a collective responsibility. It's very important that if your child has fever, that you keep them home and not give them Tylenol or ibuprofen. And when the temperature goes down, send them in. It's very important that every day parents assess their children as to whether they're healthy and safe to go. Because some of the symptoms of COVID overlap with other illnesses, it is going to be necessary to dismiss children with coughs that are new, until they can be evaluated and see, what the circumstance is. So it is going to be, it's going to be challenging for the school nurses, but I think that it starts with everyone in the community trying to do their best to make sure that at least when they send their child to school, if they're in-person learning, that they're healthy at the time that they leave.
Yeah. Scott, I think the last time you were on the program, we were discussing school start times, and you brought up the issue of busing and how expensive it is to get students to school. But what are the protocols to keep students safely distanced on the buses, and do you have enough buses to do this?
So we do. We have reached out to families to ask for their cooperation. So what is uniquely different about this year compared to any other year is that typically, as the school superintendent, I am encouraging families to use the buses so that we don't have a lot of congestion on the town streets around our schools. And for the first time ever, I am strongly encouraging families to drive their child to school if at all possible, because our bus capacity is now down to one child per seat, and so we have 23 children maximum that any bus can take, when typically our buses were having 50 children on them. So we are reworking how parent drop-off will look like, and are working with our families to, we had to do a survey to figure out who will absolutely need bus transportation, but it has created an interesting twist in terms of managing the launch of a new school year.
Yeah. So what's been your biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge has been, trying to make sure that we are launching and offering two completely different educational programs. Typically you're going into a school year and saying, here's the in-person learning and we're just focused on that. But we have this other educational program that we are putting out there for a quarter of our families that have chosen it, and trying to staff that program while also staffing the program for the students that are going to be in person. And it has stretched, some of the school funding dollars a little thinner than in past years.
Yeah. Scott Carpenter is the superintendent of the Monomoy Regional School District. Thanks, Scott, for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mindy.
Greg, washing hands, wearing a mask, physical distancing, this is, what public health experts are recommending, you're recommending. And I think it's frustrating, when we go out and we see people not following those rules. And, you can see some arguments happening where people are kind of challenging. You're going the wrong way down the grocery aisle. And so thoughts on, you talk about community, and it really does take all of us, right?
Right. It really, those are exactly the points. And you can't emphasize that enough. Wash your hands, wear your mask, keep it over your nose. and keep your distance. And, you know, if we all really focus on that, then I think we can get there. You know, the fourth step is trying to focus our energy in a positive direction. We all know how stressful this is, and trying to remain calm so that we can make level-headed decisions within our community, I think would be the fourth step, because none of us function well when we're panicked.
That's right.
If we can look at what's going on in our community and say, what are the real issues and what's the real infection rate and are we safe today, then communicate that to staff from schools so that they can remain calm and they can communicate that to their students. We can send our energy in a positive direction, and if we do the opposite, then we really sabotage our chance of success.
All right. Let's talk to Henry, who's giving us a call from Eastham. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Mindy. I'd like to offer you a parent's perspective.
Sure.
Except in this case, our daughter is a 49-year-old teacher, in a fourth-grade teacher in an off-Cape school. And we're really concerned about her going back. Her school did have an HVAC analysis, but the teachers found out through the custodians, which are really the lifeblood of almost any school, that the HVAC company never actually showed up to inspect the filters and the system. They simply relied on plans. So she's going back. Our daughter's going back. She's bought her own, or the family's bought her own HVAC machine. But we're a little concerned about what's going to happen when the windows in the classroom have to be closed when it gets cold. We're also concerned that she'll be eating lunch with her class 4 days a week. Of course, nobody will have a mask on, so it's just...
It's scary.
Early on in the whole pandemic situation, we were talking about testing. There's been no mention of testing anyone going back to any school, as far as I've heard. They were going to be taking temperatures, then they decided that they couldn't do that. She's very good at remote teaching. She could have been doing a much more robust lesson last March when she went online to teach, but she was the policy of her district was just to kind of keep kids in a holding pattern, and none of us could understand that. So I think she was looking forward to teaching a regular robust lessons remotely.
Yeah. Henry, I think you speak for a lot of parents of school teachers, and I think we're all concerned about everyone's health. And you know, thank you for sharing your perspective. Dr. Greg Parkinson, thank you for joining us this morning. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
We could
keep going here, but we really appreciate you taking time to talk with us this morning.
My pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.